This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On today's podcast, the troubling trend in recent years of more extremist views becoming part of mainstream political dialogue. Julia Eppner is a researcher specializing in far-right extremism, reciprocal radicalization, conspiracy myths, and terrorism prevention. Her new book is Going Mainstream: How Extremists Are Taking Over. And joining her in today's episode is Carl Miller. He's the research director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. If you'd like to hear this episode ad-free, just head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership or subscribe to our channel on the Apple Podcasts app to ditch the ads and enjoy lots of premium member-only content too. But now, let's join Carl Miller with more.
I'm Carl Miller, and today I am joined by Julia Eppner. She's a senior resident research fellow at the Institute of Student Dialogue. She's also an undercover extremism radicalization researcher, which fueled her book called Going Dark. And now her next, Going Mainstream, How Extremists Are Taking Over. So from QAnon to incels, White Lives Matter to anti-vaxxers, she takes us in that book into the online subcultures that now, she argues, are rushing back out of their once online backwaters to affect the cultures that surround all of us. And I hope today she'll be showing us who these people are, what they want, how they operate, and why we can't actually ignore them anymore. Julia, very warm welcome to you to Intelligence Squared.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we've known each other a long time, haven't we? So let's go back a bit to your first book. What was Going Dark all about?
Yeah, Going Dark was a book that I published 3 or 4 years, actually, 4 years ago, pre-COVID, pre-pandemic. So it was in a time when I was still looking at really the extreme fringes to look at radicalization trends. It was not something that had already been mainstream to the extent that we could find it in public discourse or even in political circles. So I mostly spent a lot of time in kind of the hidden dark corners of the internet, lurking around, chatting with extremists. I did go undercover with both jihadist groups, but also with extreme right groups back then. So with neo-Nazi groups, but also with, for example, ISIS hacking groups, and also with some conspiracy myth communities that were still relatively fringe back then. And what was interesting to see over the course of, I would say, the last 4 years, especially since the outbreak of the pandemic and the Ukraine war and the economic crisis, is that we've seen that a lot of these extremist ideas that I could spot in these very dark corners of the internet back then have now leaked more and more into the mainstream. So that's also what prompted me to write this new book.
So the once hidden or mysterious or kind of subterranean ideas you now see kind of emerging and recolonizing the world, kind of like beginning to weave in and out of the cultures that affect all of us?
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of the subculture references. Sometimes even far-right populist politicians flirt with these audiences by giving a little hint or by using some of these subculture codes and references and symbols. And we've also seen them occur at mass street protests, especially in the COVID lockdown protests, but also now in some of the pro-Putin and pro-Russian protests that we've seen across the world. And it's quite interesting how there is a clear global dynamic there with, for example, incidents like the US Capitol riots, but also other attacks on democratic institutions where we saw very similar slogans, very similar banners and featuring the same, essentially the same conspiracy myths, the same symbols. of Q. And that was quite interesting to watch from, obviously also from the inside of QAnon, but also as a researcher to analyze how is this global dynamic leaking into the mainstream.
Well, let's talk a bit, Julie, about how you research all of this, because I know you have a kind of very proactive and very brave way of actually bringing yourself into these groups and bringing the reader with you. So how do you go about actually understanding extremists and all the other people that you write about on kind of human terms?
I usually combine analysis with deeper insights from the inside of movements. So I always try to understand what is driving humans basically to join extremist groups or to stay in extremist communities. So I usually adopt avatars or fake identities, if you want to call it like that. Beginning in the online sphere, usually I set up a range of social media accounts and I create an identity that is both credible and also sustainable. And then I'm usually recruited into the movements and I can watch them from closer and from the inside. So the idea is to get insights on a very human level, but also sometimes insider information concerning their strategies, their tactics. So I've joined identitarian meetings of Generation Identities, hidden or secret strategy meeting in an Airbnb in Brixton. But I've also joined, for example, a neo-Nazi festival on the border of Germany and Poland. I've been to lots of protests of conspiracy theorists and radical pro-Putin proponents. So it's usually a mix of online investigations, but sometimes I do take them offline as well.
Have you ever had a moment where you thought this is actually getting a bit dangerous?
Quite a few, yeah. I think the biggest danger is usually not really, I don't feel that anyone would attack me when I'm actually going undercover offline. I mean, maybe a punch in the face if they uncovered my identity, that's probably something they might be willing to do, but usually they're quite concerned about your image. So they would probably not do it in a public location, especially not at a protest or at a public event like a festival. Even though that neo-Nazi festival that I went to, there were quite a lot of people with a criminal record. So there I wasn't so certain. But I think the bigger threat is almost from these online harassment campaigns and doxing campaigns where they've tried to leak my address, my personal details. And that combined with real threats like death threats and sexualized threats, that's pretty intimidating. And I think that is actually something that I'm most worried about, that these online campaigns can, of course, manifest themselves in real offline violence, which we've seen many times in the past.
Do you find it difficult sometimes to kind of balance? Because I know that empathy is an important value for you as well. I know you write, even the most disturbing individuals I encountered have stories that are worth listening to. Do you find it difficult sometimes to kind of balance that need to understand these people as people with both maybe the danger they represent to you, but also, you know, the monstrous ideas and beliefs that they can hold?
Yeah, I guess I often feel empathy for their underlying grievances and for their own stories, but I don't feel any sympathy or even empathy for their ideologies. And that's, I think there's a really important distinction here. On a very human level, I feel like there is always a connecting point, or there's always an emotional bridge that is also really important, I think, for de-radicalizing them or eventually for getting them out of these extremist groups. But on an ideological level, of course, it's sometimes really hard to watch, especially young people getting into a conspiracy myth or far-right extremist networks where I can't even say anything in the moment to counter their narratives or to counter that. Or sometimes you might even, if you're undercover, you might have to laugh about a racist joke. And that's, I think those are the hardest moments when it's actually not about the human stories, but when it's more on the ideological level.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of these subcultures. Because I'm conscious that there might be people listening to this, they've heard incels or White Lives Matter or QAnon or anti-vaxxers kind of floating around, but never probably got to know people on an individual basis that might be completely in the middle of these kinds of movements. So take us into one of these, Julia, one of these kind of online subcultures. Kind of, what do they sound like? What do they believe? What do they like to hang out with and to talk to?
One of the the communities that I found the most interesting for my most recent book, for going mainstream, was the incels subculture, because there is a whole, it's of course part of the wider misogynist mosaic of communities and subcultures on the internet, but it's a very diverse community. Something that I hadn't expected was that there are both individuals, of course, the ones that we're reading about in the news that are really prone to violence against others, that might even resort to terrorist attacks. We've seen the Plymouth attack last year. We've seen other attacks like the Toronto van attack, where their hate towards women and towards people in general can really manifest itself in terrorist attacks. But there's quite a significant part of the incel community that is more prone to violence against themselves, I would say to suicide. And they have such a deep hatred for themselves in the end. And sometimes that is channeled towards a demonized outgroup. And I think that process is really scary, but also interesting from a research perspective to watch. How can hatred against oneself be turned into something that is then channeled in a form of hatred towards others?
And at a very basic level, where does this word incel come from? How did it kind of rise in currency?
Incel stands for involuntary celibate. And the incel community has been around for quite some time, since the early 2000s, when actually a woman founded incels as a forum for seeking help, for seeking contact with others who might also be lonely, because essentially the idea of incels is to connect people who can't find a romantic or a sexual partner. So it was almost a self-help forum for people who would be lonely, who might want to make friends with people in a similar situation. That was the basis or the starting point. But then from there on, unfortunately, in the last few years, incels has been politicized and radicalized to the extent that now it's quite a toxic place, and one that is really full with anti-feminist, but even radical misogynist ideas. And that has to some extent also leaked outside of the incel community into wider mainstream subcultures. So that's what I was interested in specifically for the book, is how younger generations are now fascinated by influences like Andrew Tate, or even a rape denial narratives and ideas that are considered very misogynist, or things like the Sigma meme, which can on the outside seem quite benign, but which essentially is also very much connected to the idea in incels that actually men maybe shouldn't really be caring about women, shouldn't really give anything about what women think and just do their own thing. And that can, of course, easily be coupled with more radical misogynist narratives. And it often is in the form of memes.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
To what extent, Julia, should we see these different groups that you've mentioned as separate groups versus a kind of series of kind of linked cooperating entities? You know, is this a story of like the mainstream and something else, or is it still a story of different pockets of kind of radical rejection of mainstream ideas?
It's a good question. I would say that there is a clear link between some of these radical subcultures and the mainstream, because of course a lot of these fringe communities have the ultimate goal of becoming mainstream. And so a lot of the strategies they use are about how can we seem more legitimate? How can we make sure our ideas are taken on board by wider parts of society? And sometimes they even reach out to people who might be in a difficult situation and who might be more vulnerable or more susceptible to their ideas. And that's something we see across the board in extremist communities, regardless of their ideologies, whether we look at, that's of course a tactic that has been used by jihadists as well as by neo-Nazis, as well as by conspiracy theorists or radical misogynists. A lot of them are in the end seeking to penetrate the mainstream or whatever we call the political middle to cause radical political or societal change in the long run. And some of them have been more successful than others, but I would say COVID and the poly crisis that we've witnessed in the last few years definitely have made larger parts of the population susceptible to extreme ideas.
So Julia, across all these different subcultures, you know, Nazis or pro-Putin activists or, you know, anti-LGBT campaigners, is it clear that there are certain groups in their crosshairs, experts or journalists or researchers like you or I, or does it change depending on who they are?
It definitely, the enemy groups change a little bit, of course, depending on who they are, but often there is an underlying kind of lowest common denominator. And that is very often very deep mistrust in the media, in the established media, in the sciences, and also in politics or even in democracy to some extent. Very often, a lot of these extremist communities also find common ground in anti-Semitic ideas, anti-Semitic narratives. We've even seen it in rather unexpected places, like the misogynist incel community. There was just a report that showed the overlaps between anti-Semitism and misogyny, because some of their conspiracy myths then end up having an anti-Semitic layer, or where they blame the so-called global Jewish elites for everything. And the same is true in some of the QAnon circles that I looked into, where again anti-Semitism is often a common theme. And that's quite interesting, because those communities are not as clearly tied to anti-Semitism as, for example, neo-Nazi or jihadist groups, where it's more obvious.
Okay. Well, let's come to the main kind of meat of your argument now, I think, should have actually how this process of mainstreaming has happened. So I know in the book you kind of lay out this kind of structure where you kind of walk us through this process, you know, beginning with fringe subcultures, then international networks, alternative media ecosystems, backlashes, persuading the masses. Could you take us through each of those steps briefly to kind of give us a sense of like your narrative around kind of basically what's happened since Going Dark was published, you know, to mean that these ideas become so much more visible to us?
Yeah, absolutely. Often extremist ideas, of course, start in small fringe subcultures, but then very quickly these subcultures start to network with other like-minded communities. They form international coalitions, but then they also launch communication campaigns, either online or offline. They mobilize potentially even to offline protests or launch bigger influence campaigns online. And that those are the different steps, essentially, from fringe subcultures to in creating networks to mobilizing or communicating and mobilizing. And then in the end, there might be there might even be something like a proxy culture war, which is something that we see, of course, now with the Ukraine war. To some extent, we see that the people supportive of the Putin regime, especially the hardline pro-Putin activists in Europe that I've seen at pro-Putin protests in Germany, for example, they are very much in line with anti-liberal, very often misogynist, anti-LGBTQ ideas, and often anti-immigration ideas. So it's almost like these themes are coming together there. There is, of course, also the sense that the anti-vaccination and anti-COVID bubble has now shifted to the Ukraine war as a new topic. And again, conspiracy myths that were already present during the COVID pandemic have now adopted new narratives that are tied to the Ukraine war. And on the other side, I would say there are the pro-democratic voices or the people fighting for more a liberal democratic kind of order. And that's of course, that's on a very kind of broad level. And that's not a very nuanced look at it. It's, of course, much more nuanced than that. But I would say, broadly speaking, proxy wars might be the last step of a mainstreaming process.
What is your sense about why this has actually happened? Like, what's actually changed between going dark and going mainstream in terms of the actual drivers for these ideas and their publicity? Because you might say, well, you know, they've always, extremists have always occupied pockets of online spaces. They've always kind of been able to try and find each other. But something has kind of flipped now to mean that the world we're living in is so profoundly different to how it was 5 or 6 years ago. There's one body of argument around the platforms themselves and where the algorithms have kind of, shot these groups up into ridiculous amounts of prominence and visibility. But you actually keep mentioning these huge macroeconomic and global events as being, I think, also very central. So is it them? Is it the platforms? Is it actually the rest of society? And we've actually become more susceptible or willing to listen to extremist beliefs? Like, what's your sense of, the underlying shift here?
Based on the research that I did and also based on the conversations I had with extremists, I would say that it's a combination of all of these factors. I think we've never had a point in history where we had such a global poly crisis, so many different overlapping crises at the same time as so many new technological advances from, of course, social media that's been around for some time now, but still we don't yet fully know how to deal with it, with the algorithmic infrastructure and how they give priorities to radical content, to conspiracy myths and so on. But also the newest technologies like ChatGPT on the horizon that many people also do feel threatened by. And I think there is a sense that both the crisis that we've seen in the last few years, COVID, Ukraine war, which is a profound security crisis, and the economic crisis, and the new technologies, on the other hand, have created so many fears, but also anger, mistrust or distrust in institutions, and also just a lack of perspective, or many people, I feel, have been looking for an alternative, basically an alternative narrative that can put everything into one place and also explain some of these really complex systems in a much simpler way. That's, of course, what QAnon is, although QAnon is hugely complex if you look at the map, but essentially it boils down to demonizing an outgroup and victimizing an in-group, which extremist movements are always about. So it's always this simplification, even if on the outside QAnon might look like the most complicated conspiracy myth you've ever looked at.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a kind of extraordinary cathedral, isn't it, of conspiracies coming together nowadays.
They connect everything from explaining that the moon landing never happened to conspiracy myths about the Hollywood elites, about the Second World War, to ideas about Princess Diana's death. They really try to link it all together and then combine it with the newer narratives about COVID, the origins of COVID, the vaccinations and the purpose behind those, and the Ukraine war. It's really quite, you see that they're very opportunistic in assembling all of these different items to fit them into one global conspiracy myth.
To what extent, Julia, do you see all of this being a kind of quest for meaning and identity on the part of the people that do it? I don't know. It just seems to me that there's this almost like this anime at the heart of a kind of liberal democratic materialist age that doesn't quite seem to be satisfying the kind of needs that many of these people have for identities and senses of belonging, which they find and entirely wholesome. You know, maybe it's a kind of spirituality and forms of organized religion. I'm not sure, but there does seem to be a kind of importantly spiritual religious dimension, however grotesque that sounds when we're trying to describe, kind of Nazis or flat earthers to some of this. You know, is there Does any of that kind of chime with you?
I completely agree. I think some of these movements, most of them, have almost offered a new form of kinship identity, where these groups become the new family and the new friends. And that was, of course, very relevant in the COVID lockdowns, where a lot of people lost their social contacts. But it definitely predates that, because there is also a sense that the kind of the tendency towards a more individualist society has led to many people looking for new identity, collective identities. And the same is true for other macro trends like globalization, digitalization. Those macro trends have definitely led to a wider societal search for new collective identities. And sadly, extremist movements are extremely good at framing themselves as exclusive countercultures, as something there is a really strong social offer. And the whole radicalization process is usually, I would say, almost a side product to something much more important that's happening there, which is essentially a socialization process, a socialization into these extremist subcultures, where a lot of it is more about the symbols, the language that is spoken there, the insider jokes that are being made. It almost feels like you're entering a new world. And a lot of the users in extremist groups also use family language or kinship language. They talk of my white brothers and white sisters, my QAnon siblings or the QAnon family. And it's the same whether you look at far-right extremists or jihadists or conspiracy myth communities. It's very often this creation of a new identity. It's actually something I studied in my PhD in Oxford, where I looked specifically at identity fusion. Identity fusion is when the personal identity becomes equivalent with the group identity. And that can also make people more willing to then commit an act of violence on behalf of the group, because the group is then seen as family. And if the group is perceived as being threatened by an outside group, then there's a really big danger that a person might resort to violence to basically save the group.
And that reflection is especially sad and powerful, isn't it, when we think that the actual process of radicalization is actually taking these people out of their actual families and social groups, and often demolishing those relationships as it brings them into whatever, a new family, a QAnon family, or a neo-Nazi band of brothers, or whatever it is.
That is very true. And sometimes these techniques are more obvious, at other times they're more subtle. So ISIS groups or jihadist groups would often even tell their adherents they have to stop any contact with their families. This is now their new family, especially with what they would then call kafar or unbelievers. They have to stop any contact with them. Whereas a lot of the far-right extremist groups that I looked at, they do it in a different way. They just gamify their whole social processes and often ask something of their group members where it's clear they will have to leave behind their families, or they can't even make it to dinner anymore, because a lot of these activities take place after work in the evenings or on weekends. And you see how members of these groups sometimes end up spending their entire spare time there and really become almost addicted to that. And that is a more subtle way of removing the actual biological family and replacing it with the new group identity.
Let's lastly, Julia, talk about implications. So if these ideas are kind of boiling out of these online spaces now and these groups and kind of increasingly infecting and affecting the mainstream, which bits of the liberal democratic consensus do you see crumbling the most? Kind of how is the kind of ideational landscape, so to speak, going to be changing as a result of these processes that you see?
I guess the biggest fear that I have is that the distrust in democracy and democratic processes and institutions is decreasing with the spread of these narratives and spread of these extremist communities. So in Germany, there are already surveys that show that 5% of the population now hold anti-democratic, so-called Reichsbürger, sovereign citizens ideologies. So they're fundamentally basically against the democratic order. And that has, of course, also been reflected in increasing attacks around the world against democratic institutions. We've seen that in the US with the Capitol riots, where there were a few thousand people who actually stormed the Capitol. But surveys show that the people who were ideologically supportive of this insurrectionist movement are a much larger part or percentage of the population. We're talking about over 10 million people, or over 10 million US citizens, according to the University of Chicago survey. So that's quite a significant part of the population. And I think that is the biggest fear, that there are all these copycat incidents against democratic institutions. And of course, simultaneously, we've seen also the rise of anti-democratic and far-right populist movements and political parties. For example, the neo-fascist party Fratelli d'Italia being voted into power in Italy, or the Sweden Democrats basically entering government in Sweden. And the same dynamics can be observed in other countries like Germany, where the Alternative for Germany is peaking both in terms of its popularity and also in terms of its radicalism. So that's, I would say, hugely concerning at the moment.
Well, I always like to end my Intelligence Squared interviews looking at solutions and forwards and wherever possible optimistically. And sometimes those solutions can be really big, kind of societal, political change. But I wonder here, Julie, whether we might actually focus on individual solutions. Because I know that both you and I over COVID, you know, were bombarded with people who saw loved ones, members of their families kind of departing into these extremist kind of cult-like kind of groups. And I was completely at a loss as to what to suggest to anyone. But I hope that you're not. So when people that might be listening to this might see a member of their family beginning to, for one reason or another, kind of start that journey, what can they do? Is there anything they can do?
I definitely think that there are things that the immediate environment and the families or friends of people who are on track to radicalization can do. I would say that that emotional bridge is really important, because we've seen that we don't really get far with facts. So countering conspiracy myths or extremist ideologies with facts is usually not very successful. But understanding, I think the most important thing is to understand what the psychological purposes are, the individual psychological purposes are of conspiracy myths, because every individual that believes in a conspiracy myth, usually there's usually some kind of underlying psychological need or something that drives them to want to believe in a crazy idea or a crazy narrative about something. And I think it's a lot of it is about understanding what that is. And family members or friends are in the best position to do that, to actually get to that point. The other thing is that I do think that the identity piece is really important. And based on my research, it is necessary to break through these new identity lines that extremist groups are trying to form. So where they try to cut off any outgroups from the new identity that is being formed. I think it's important to reverse that dynamic. And that could be done by highlighting what are actually elements that this person doesn't have in common with the new group that they joined. Trying to really show them there are actually so many levels on which they shouldn't be identifying or even fusing with that group in terms of their identity, because they're also someone else. They also have other layers to their identity. So it's often about highlighting those. But of course, that's hugely, hugely difficult. I do think it's always worth an attempt, because at this stage, there's usually nothing that you can lose, because you might already be likely to lose a family member or a friend to extremist groups. And I think it's worth giving it a try.
Indeed. Well, Julie Ebner, thank you so much for such a fascinating conversation. And thanks for listening, everyone that's joined us today. The book again, and it's a great book, is called Going Mainstream, How Extremists Are Taking Over. It's available now from your local bookshop. I'm Carmilla, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle with editing from Tom Hall. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then once again, head over to intelligencesquared.com.